I'm good. Yeah.
Good morning, everybody. I'm gonna get this out of the way. Hello, good to see everybody here today. My name is Troy Swanson. I'm the Library Department Chair. This coming July marks the 250th anniversary of the signing of the Declaration of Independence, kind of the start of the American Revolution. So not kind of, but the start maybe. And we are this academic year and next academic year doing a series of events connected in all different angles and thinking about the American Revolution. With the state of democracy in America, it seemed like a pertinent topic that we should be talking about and considering. So for today, I'm very happy to welcome historian Jim McIntyre to talk. We are going all the way back to the early parts of the American Revolution, before it was an American Revolution, to think about the French and Indian War and kind of setting the stage for what's to come for the revolution itself. So this is our very first event. Jim is a good friend of the library, historian. He actually gets invited to Naval War College. I get that one right. Mm-hmm. Gets invited to give talks about this kind of stuff. And let me say, I know that the Seven Years' War, and as we call it in America, the French and Indian War, is one of his specialties. So it's a very great treat to have a scholar that's a friend of yours who can talk on the thing that he has studied the most in his career. So I want to say thank you to Jim for his time and being here, and thank you to all of you. And I will turn it over to Jim. All
right. Thank you, Troy, and thank you for inviting me to do this. How many of you heard about the French and Indian War somewhere along the way, primary school, secondary school, right? So that is a theater, a part of what we call the Seven Years' War, or the Global War for Empire, or the Third Carnatic War. There's a number of things going on globally, and that's kind of what I'm going to be addressing with this talk today. And so to give you a quick overview of what I'm going to do, I'm going to look at some assumptions and give some background on what starts this conflict, the Seven Years' War, going. There's a big shift just as it's starting up called the Diplomatic Revolution. I plan to talk about some of the major figures because this was a time when most of the states, well, really all of the states in Europe, were ruled by monarchies. And so one person essentially could decide what would happen for hundreds of thousands or even millions of people. And so getting an idea of some of those personalities, I think, is important to understand what happens. And then just briefly, I'm going to go over the different theaters, the different areas where this conflict took place, and then finally go through some outcomes. So, and then hopefully answer any questions you may have. My first assumption, right? In the US, we focus on this French and Indian War. Okay, but again, this is only one component. Okay. As far as background, really things go back for this to 1740. The Emperor of Austria and this Holy Roman Empire in Europe, Charles VI, died. His daughter, Maria Theresa, becomes empress. And the problem there for Charles was in Austrian inheritance law, only men could inherit, but he only had a daughter. So he got the other crowned heads of Europe, if you will, to agree to this deal where, okay, we're going to restrict that. We're going to pull that law back just on this occasion. Right away, though, when the events transpire, people break their pledge, and so you get this conflict that goes on for 8 years. One of the other new monarchs, Frederick II of Prussia, grabs a territory from Austria, and that kind of sets things in motion. Okay, the war goes for 8 years. At the very end of it, everybody basically has to give back what they took. Consequently, no one is really happy with this peace in 1748, the Peace of Aix-la-Chapelle. The only reason they agree to it is because most of these countries are either broke or on the borders of being broke. Okay, and so everybody assumes that things are going to start again. Okay, and before they start again, so some characters. Okay, there's Frederick. This is done later in his life. He comes to the throne of Prussia in 1740. He combines being the monarch and the head of the armed forces in his own person, and that will give him some advantages with things. His main goal is to make his state, Prussia, which is kind of small and unimportant at the time. So these areas here in red, this area up here, this is the land he took Silesia from Maria Theresa. Okay, they're not contiguous. He wants to link his territories together and defend them. That's kind of his priority. Okay, Maria Theresa is his arch nemesis. She wants Silesia back, and because Frederick dared challenge her, she wants to basically wipe Prussia. Goal. Okay. She is in the direct ruler of this area here, and also as Empress has a lot of say in Central Europe. Louis XV, King of France, he's kind of the tragic figure in all of this to me. He is the great grandson of Louis XIV, and he, you know, you hear things like the man who would be king. Well, he's the guy who never wanted to be king, was not very well prepared for it. And part of that was his grandfather was on the throne for so long. And the way monarchies worked at this time, briefly, as soon as there was an heir apparent, right, as soon as they had someone who met the criteria, they would start preparing that person as a child to be the next monarch. The problem with Louis XIV was he outlived so many of his, not only children, but grandchildren, that they really didn't know who was going to be the next monarch. And so he wasn't prepared very well, and he really didn't care for the job by most accounts. But still, he is a major figure in that he is King of France. His grandfather's last accomplishment, this being Louis XIV, was to put one of his other progeny on the throne of Spain. And I mention this because you then get something called the Family Compact, where France and Spain have it's not quite an alliance, it's more of an understanding. And so, again, he can potentially wield a great deal of power, not only in Europe, but in the Americas, in Asia, and so forth, because of the colonial empires they're starting. Okay, Elizabeth II Romanov, Tsarina of Russia, she was a progeny of Peter the Great, and like her father, she is seeking to expand Russian powers. One of the big choices that Peter made during his reign was, if you look at a map, right, like this, okay, more of Russia is actually in Asia. And so is Russia an Asian state or a European state? And Peter, as monarch, had said, we're going to be a player in European affairs. We're going to be involved in Europe. Okay. Finally, George II of Britain. Okay, he is the second of what are known as the Hanoverians. They're actually a dynasty out of Northern Europe. Okay, Hanover, and in the early 1700s, George, the Elector of Hanover, becomes George I of Great Britain. Okay, George II succeeds him. George has really got two things that he's focused on. Okay, one is maintaining this connection to Hanover. He speaks German as his first language. He still sees himself as kind of the leader of this German state first, and Britain second. Okay. So those are the outlooks that these people bring to things. Now, what actually starts things rolling, many of you probably heard about in American history, okay, You have the royal governor of Virginia Colony, Robert Dinwiddie. He has been in service in Virginia for some time. He is preparing to retire. And so he asks the king for a favor, a bonus for years of service, which George II is more than happy to grant him because it doesn't cost him anything. The way they do this, okay, you see this brown shaded area here? This is a couple hundred thousand acres. It basically spans western Pennsylvania, eastern Ohio today. It's right around Pittsburgh. That's his retirement package, okay? And so the way this works, and Virginia planters, slaveholders, royal officials are doing this kind of stuff all the time, where they get the land and then they divvy it up and they sell off parcels of it, and that's how they make money out of it, okay? But to do those things, he needs to know, he has to have it surveyed, right? He has to find out if it's quality land, if it's good for farming and so forth. So he sends a young Virginia planter who's on his way up socially, George Washington. He's also a surveyor, by the way, helps. Washington goes out, surveys this land, but he, in surveying it, finds that the French are also there, coming down from New France, Canada, today, and establishing basically a military post at what is now Pittsburgh, right? Fort Duquesne. He brings this information back to Dinwiddie. Dinwiddie sends George back with some Virginia militia and some native guides, okay? One of whom is Tanner Grayson. He is a leader in the Delawares, okay? The Delaware were a, so, and I'll probably use the term First Peoples. That's what they use in Canada for Native Americans. I prefer it because I think it's much more accurate and descriptive. The Iroquois Confederacy, which consists at this time of five main groups, okay? But there are many subsidiaries, there are many smaller groups within this region from basically upstate New York down through Maryland and into Virginia. There are many other smaller groups that have some kind of allegiance to the Iroquois, or they're essentially tributaries. In other words, you know, we'll support the Iroquois as long as the Iroquois don't harm us. And where this plays into the picture is the Iroquois have been giving Delaware lands over to the British colonists and basically running roughshod over the Delawares. And Tanner Grayson, as a Delaware leader, is fed up with this. There's a large conference just before this of various First Peoples with the British government. And when Tanner Grayson stood up to speak, the Iroquois leaders laughed at him, which is a huge insult, right? They basically kind of silenced him and insulted him all at once. And I go into this background because what happens out in what is now western Pennsylvania, a place called Jamonville's Glen, okay? Washington and his Virginians and Tanner Grayson and his scouts surround a French force led by a Lieutenant Jamonville, okay? They capture them, and then Washington gives a letter from Dinwiddie to Jamonville as the highest ranking French officer. In short, it says, you know, Dinwiddie is saying to the French, this is my land, you need to get off it. But for George here, this is so far going very well. This is the first time he's ever done anything like this. It's his first command, right? This has gone smoothly. We've delivered the message. Let's get out of here before anything goes awry. Except he then kills Jamonville. And his motive, we think, was to start a conflict between the French and the English in the hopes that they would basically eradicate one another and the Delawares would get their lands back. Well, he succeeds in part of this. So look, the end result of this encounter in July 1754 is Virginia Colony is at war with France, in theory, right? Like, They've performed this action. It's an act of war. News of this goes back to London, to Paris, and the other capitals. And there's a question to be answered. Do we support, right? Does France support New France? Does Britain support Virginia Colony? And you have this sort of network of alliances. This is nowhere near as formal as we think of alliances today. That's something important to keep in mind. But these relationships have stood for the better part of a century and a half. You have Great Britain, who tends to support Austria against France on the continent of Europe. Likewise, a number of the smaller German states, like Hanover, Hesse-Darmstadt, and so forth, support Britain. It's their insurance policy against French expansion in Europe. France, on the other hand, has a relationship with Prussia, because they both are opposing Austria, and some of the other smaller states that oppose Austrian expansion. Within a year, this switch occurs, okay? Britain then lines up with Prussia, these German states, Portugal, which is a longtime trading partner of Britain. If you've ever read about port wine, that's where the name comes from. It's Portuguese wine that they would import into Britain. So there's this trade relationship that goes back literally to the Middle Ages. Okay. On the other hand, France switches their long-term foe. Austria becomes their ally in this. And there is something of a religious dimension that should be at least recognized. Okay. Britain and Prussia and many of the German states that join them tended to be Protestant. France, Austria, and Spain are all Roman Catholic, as are some of the smaller German states that sided with them. Spain and Portugal tried to avoid being involved with this, but they end up being pulled in later on. That's why I have the date there. All right, so the sides line up, and they decide to go to war with one another. And this is why they call it, right, the First Global War, or Great War for Empire. As you can see, it is occurring all over the planet. Okay, there's fighting in Europe, North America, which we've all heard about previously, also in South Asia. Okay, there's a lot of naval encounters in the Atlantic as well as the Pacific and the Indian Oceans. I'm not going to dig down into specific battles or anything like that. I will say, okay, just briefly, in Europe, okay, Frederick makes his main goal survival, okay, which makes sense. If you look at the map here, the little gray shaded areas to the top, that's his state again, Brandenburg, Prussia. He's surrounded. He's got the Russians moving in from the east, Sweden from the north, Austria from the south, France from the west. He's basically surrounded. Again, that's where his role, all of his opponents, you have the monarch who tends to stay back in the capital, and they send their armies out to fight. The problem is the generals for their armies have to write letters asking for permission to do pretty much anything and send it back to the king and wait to get a response before they can do it, or they risk, you're really not going to have a long career if you run afoul of your monarch. Right? If you do the wrong thing in the king's or queen's eyes, you're in trouble, okay? So Frederick has this advantage where he's both king and he's a general with his army. The war here stalemates pretty briefly. They start fighting in 1756. By 1758, there's a kind of balance and no one is really coming out ahead. Okay. Asia's very different. Okay. There's not direct involvement by the British or French government, but both countries have what are known as their East India Companies, right? The British East India Company. over here, we hear about the British East India Company when it comes to the Boston Tea Party, right? So that's it's that. But most European states had a trading company that was licensed by the king that traded with the various princely states in India. And to give you an idea, the subcontinent here is actually divided between a couple of things. You have the Maratha Confederacy, and this would be like the central part of the subcontinent. You have these other princely states, right, Arcot, Mysore, and so forth, to the south. And then furthest to the north, you have the Mughal Empire. Okay. A key player in a lot of this is going to be Sadashivrao Bao, okay, who was the current leader of the Maratha Confederacy. And you see he's not leader for very long. Now, bigger picture, okay, the Maratha start out on the west coast, okay, in the area in red. They are responding to the Mughals who are moving southward. This Mughal Empire was attempting to conquer the entire subcontinent. Okay, and because it basically overextended itself, and this is in the early 1700s, and a couple of things are happening. The Mughals are overextending themselves. These smaller princely states in the south are resisting. And one of the things that aids them in their resistance is trading with these East India companies. Because one of the things that these East India companies recognize as they start trading with the various princely states is, hey, this isn't really well run. And so the local prince will, at times, quite voluntarily turn over things like raising, collecting tax revenue to these European companies, and they're much more successful at it. But what that translates into is that the prince can then pay for his troops, and he can, you know, be more stable when he's opposing an opponent. All right. So it's these different companies, okay? And there's a contest between them over these different territories in the south, and this kind of comes together, you know. And the one thing that about the Indian subcontinent that you might hear about in an American history class is the Battle of Plassey, right? That's what usually ends up in the history books. Plassey is fought on the eastern side of the subcontinent in 1757, and from the perspective of folks in the subcontinent, it's not all that important. Okay, because what's really important is there's a power struggle going on. I mentioned this Mughal Empire in the north. It's imploding. So of course, right, their great opponent here, now again, this is the area that eventually the Maratha will have some nominal control over. Okay, they're looking to move northward and drive out their long-term opponent. But what they're not really thinking of, right, is a successor state to the Safavid Empire, right? This Afghani Empire, and that's where, back up here, it's where you get Ahmad Shah Durrani. Okay, he was a Persian general, and he became something of a free agent. Right? What happens is these two, the biggest thing for the region here is a clash between these two at a place called Panipat, okay, that we never read about. But it basically determines who's going to control the eastern half of India for about the next 30 years until well into the 19th, or until we start getting into the 19th century. Okay. And then finally, right, with North America, you have this French and Indian War. The first few years over here do not go well for Britain. Okay. A lot of that is it's just not very well managed. They expect colonists who are on the far frontiers of their territory, of their empire, to willingly support what the British want them to do, not what the colonists want to do. That changes with William Pitt the Elder. He becomes essentially Prime Minister of Britain and changes their policy. Okay. And that leads to a major turnaround, both along the eastern seaboard and into what is now Canada, also in the Caribbean. Okay, the Caribbean factors into this in that you have these sugar islands, and basically they're massive sugar plantations. Okay, they generate enormous revenue for whichever country owns them, quote unquote, right? Britain or France. And so one of the strategic ideas that comes up is, say, if Britain grabs a French sugar island, it's a double win. In other words, they deprive the French of the money that it generates, and that money then goes into British coffers. Okay, so that's going on. It's essentially a money grab. Okay. All right. So what finally occurs, right, there's a turnaround in North America. British forces take Quebec, okay, and then Montreal, and France has no, France is basically on the verge of bankruptcy. They start negotiating peace. And it's kind of like dominoes falling. When they finally agree to stop fighting one another, the other countries in Europe that are exhausted agree to start negotiating, and this comes to an end. But meanwhile, what Britain has been doing, right, has been using their navy, going around the world and grabbing colonies, kind of like that example I gave of the sugar islands. So one of the big takeaways and first here is that this really establishes what they call the first British Empire, okay? Because of the East India Company's success in India, the British East India Company and then later Britain will dominate and colonize in India, okay? I mentioned briefly Spain and Portugal at the start of this. What happens there, 1762, Louis XV of France calls on this family compact. Hey, Spain, help us out. Spain really doesn't want to get into the war. Economically, militarily, they are not in a good position, but they honor this compact, which means they go to war against Britain. Britain then uses their navy to attack places like Havana, Cuba, West Florida, the Philippines. Again, and they capture some of these for a time. So whenever they are in control of them, they are pulling the wealth out, okay? But this also means, you know, Spain is going to be further weakened, okay? Another big outcome, Prussia survives. It's not defeated. It's not crushed by this alliance. And longer term, that means that Prussia is going to be the state that leads the unification of Germany, which is going to create a very militarized, hierarchical Germany in Northern Europe that's also going to disrupt this balance of power, which I'll talk about more in a few minutes. Okay, so that's a very long-term consequence of this. Okay, Russia, which plays a significant role on the European continent, I just didn't have much time to get into it, this establishes them as a major power in European affairs, and they're still that today, right? They are still a major concern, okay? Okay, how does all this relate to the 250th anniversary of the Declaration of Independence and the American Revolution? Okay, and so I'm going to ask you, what's the answer you've heard since grammar school? What does the French and Indian War have to do with all of this? Vince, yeah.
After the whole war, Great Britain needed money to repay the damages, and so they, in turn, the American colonies were taxed as a result.
Okay. The taxes, yeah. Okay, there's that direct connection via Washington. Very good, Jason. So there's a couple of things, right, that connect them. The taxation, and so here's the thing. Okay. Britain now, briefly at least, has all of, you know, North America to the Mississippi, also up through the St. Lawrence Waterway, right? they have West Florida, they have Cuba, right? They have these other possessions in the Caribbean. All of this, from their mindset, right? This needs to be governed. This needs to be patrolled. Also, because of this conflict, right? Now these colonists along the East Coast in North America, do they have to worry about being attacked any longer? Are there going to be wars with the French? No, because the French are gone. This has to be governed. So basically, it's the cost of sort of governing and having security for this much enhanced empire. Okay. And the British government, and another huge factor is the debt. Okay, the British national debt almost doubles within 7 years. The British financial system can handle it, but they know they're going to need new sources of revenue. And the British people, those living in the British Isles, England, Scotland, Wales, Ireland, are already the most heavily taxed people on the planet. Every tax that we complain about in the coming decade, basically they're already paying. They're paying taxes on tea, they're paying taxes on paper, and so forth. And so the perspective in London is, well, these colonists are really benefiting from this. Maybe they should pay some of it. Okay. Okay. And some of you have been in my classes when I've asked this. Every January 1st in Illinois, we get a whole spate of new taxes. Are any of you ever excited? Do you look forward to the new taxes? Show of hands. Okay, there's always one. Okay, but really, and I know why you're doing it, because you want to be the one. Okay, we don't look forward to taxes. Okay, but part of the trade-off there is, right, part of the trade-off is we have a voice in what happens with those taxes, right? We have a representative government. Now, the people in England have that too, right? In Parliament, in the House of Commons, at least some of them do. But over here, do we have anything like that for the colonists with England at this time? No. So it's not just the tax revenue. I mean, the point I'm driving at is it's not just the tax revenue. It's the idea that literally taxation without representation. And that's what's going to start really creating this as you get waves of new taxes, also protests against those taxes. Okay. Another thing that comes up out of this, France loses, as I've already stated, much of their empire. They're not happy about this. So they're looking for a chance at revenge against Britain. Okay. And when after our War of Independence breaks out. Okay. Put it this way. In 1775, there's Lexington and Concord, the fighting starts. Already the French had agents over here trying to gauge our opinion. Are these colonists serious? Are they really thinking of breaking away and becoming independent? So they're already kind of testing the waters, right? Is this something we want to get involved in? 1777, you have this battle in upstate New York, Saratoga. A British army surrenders to the colonists, and that's really, in part, a major turning point. It's also the American resistance that were in and around Philadelphia. It's the combination of the two. France decides to opt in, okay? They give us incredible amounts of support. Now, keep in mind, they're also in a lot of debt from this 7 years war, and before they can pay that down, before they can recover, they are supporting us with lots of free aid, okay? So their national debt goes up, which creates conditions later for the French Revolution. Okay. Again, Britain and the East India Company will be the main European influence. The French East India Company is driven out with Plassey. Okay. The Mughals losing at Panipat, they're going to, so there's really no consolidated force that can withstand European encroachment. Okay. And then the last thing, for many of the states in Europe, okay, one of the things you notice when you look at the American Revolution, American War of Independence, Britain doesn't have any friends, right? What happened to Prussia? What happened to these other states? Well, basically, everyone is now worried that Britain has become way too powerful. Okay, they have this idea of balance of power, that no one should be so strong as to overawe everyone else on the continent. So Britain seems to be filling that portrait, and so other states are now trying to resist. Okay, so those, and a lot of those different factors come together as the colonists, you know, are resisting these taxes and so forth. Other European states are either going to actively engage, or they're going, what happens in Eastern Europe, you have what's called the League of Armed Neutrality, which basically Prussia, Austria, Russia refuse to support Great Britain. Okay, so there's the connections. Questions? Vince, yeah, go on. So the question for anyone who didn't hear it, was there anything happening in South America during this 7 years war? And yes, absolutely. Again, the British are using their sea power to go around and grab parts of the Spanish Empire and at least occupy them for a time. Okay, and grab whatever economic gains they can. Okay, Jason, yeah, go on.
Was there any other British colonies that, or any other colonies in general after the 7 years' war that tried to break away as well with America as well? Because all we ever hear about is like the American Revolution, but I'm trying to wonder, like, was there any other places that were like taxed as hard?
No. I mean, that's the very, very, very short answer. But the reason behind that is you have, so the British absolutely have these colonies in the Caribbean, right? These sugar islands that are basically giant plantations. And so you have this very small white elite planter group, right, running roughshod with incredible brutality and inhumanity over 4 or 5 times their number in African slaves. And so they're, the colonists along the East Coast try to make connections, but these planters, I mean, their greatest fear is slave rebellion, understandably so. And so they are more than happy to stay part of the British Empire to keep British troops there to maintain that their system that they've built. So that's the reason why. As far as one of the things that, you know, Britain gets new colonies, right, as well, Canada. And one of the reasons you would assume, right, that this former French colony that has been, the French have been fighting the British for some time on and off now, the French in Canada would be more than willing to rise up again. There's a governor, a royal governor sent over from England, Guy Carleton, who's actually really a smart politician and diplomat in for Canada, not for the East Coast, because what he does is he gets this thing passed through Parliament in Britain called the Quebec Act. And what it does is it guarantees the French colonists in Canada that they can, their Roman Catholic religion won't be interfered with. That's really important to them. And the lands that they own won't be interfered with. So everybody can, you know, look, you're now going to pay taxes to England instead of France, but otherwise nothing's, you're not going to be harmed. And so they're very happy with this deal. So they're, and they don't want to rock the boat. Right? They don't want to challenge it. But because of that, it actually drives more of a wedge between the colonists on the East Coast, right, the 13 colonies, and Great Britain, because it's like, oh, so you're guaranteeing these special privileges to the area we just helped you conquer, but now you're taxing us more. Okay, so it does. It increases tensions. So. Others? Anyone? Yeah, Vincent. Wait for the mic.
I don't know if this is around the same time, but how did Australia, I guess, if it was around, react to Seven Years' War, if it was?
Australia hasn't quite really coalesced yet. So, and it's going to be one of two penal colonies of Great Britain. So it's a prison. They're really not going to be looking for support from Australia. Because they wouldn't. Right.
Was there any other major powers that tried to help the U.S. during the, because you said earlier that it was with, like, Prussia and, like, France and people stopped supporting Britain. Was there any other powers that stopped supporting Britain as well for support of the colonies?
Yes. The first European state to recognize the United States was the Dutch Republic, actually. And they end up, and it's kind of the politics of the time. Because of that and various other factors, they end up at war with Britain. Spain also enters, and that's an area that historians are, in the United States, are really just starting to get into. And Spain also has to kind of tread a fine line. You know, if you think about it from the perspective of the Spanish government in Madrid, they still have colonies, Mexico to the southern tip of South America. If you're the king of Spain, do you really want to support an uprising by colonies against the home government? This could go set a very bad precedent. And so what the Spanish end up doing, and the French are very much involved. Two French ministers, Vergennes and Choisil, really work diligently and convince the Spanish foreign minister, Florida Blanca, to bring Spain in, and finally Spain agrees to enter the war as an ally of France. So we're gonna back the other monarchy. But things that are becoming more evident, like the connection there is, okay, 1781, you have Yorktown, right? The British surrender, and that's like the last big fight in North America. Well, what makes that possible is a fleet of French ships coming up the East Coast and preventing the British from getting any support, okay? What makes that possible is a Spanish fleet that takes over patrolling in the Caribbean for them. So they really are, like, even though they're in the background, that, without that, the French couldn't have come up the coast to Virginia, okay? So there's connections between them. But even consider, like, the League of Armed Neutrality sends a very clear message to London that these other powers aren't going to support you. Likewise, so by the time of our Revolutionary War, the Russian monarch has changed. Okay, Elizabeth is gone, and now it's Catherine II, Catherine the Great. And you've all heard of the Hessians, right? The German troops that were sent over here by the British. Well, the King of England he sent a message to Catherine basically saying, so can I buy 80,000 Russians? Her reply was classic, and she literally wrote, I do not deal in the slave trade, which was kind of a 1-2 punch at George, because Britain is still very much engaged in the slave trade. And also, like, hey, no, I'm not going to sell my people. What are you, insane? So she's basically criticizing him for using mercenaries and for being involved in the slave trade all at once. Okay, and Catherine considered herself very much a part of this big intellectual movement going on, this Enlightenment in Europe. So, any others? Faculty?
Yeah. Okay.
I'm good.
Okay, good.
All right.
How about a round of applause? Thank you.
Thank you,
Jim. Thanks for coming.
Thank you all.